Welcome. My name is Stephen Levy. I'm chairman of the New York Board of Directors of the Middle East Forum. And I'd like to introduce you to you our vice chairman, Nina Rosenwald. You know, about 2 months ago, the Hillel at Emory University was, two Molotov cocktails were thrown at it. In Mumbai, the terrorists said their prime goal was to kill the people at the Chabad house. And just last week, there was a Muslim woman shouting, "You need a big oven," in Fort Lauderdale. These are very challenging times, and that's one reason why we're all here. We understand how the Middle East Forum is at the center of a lot of this fight. So before I introduce our speaker, Mr. Spencer, allow me to tell you a little bit about the Middle East Forum. I think that the think tank founded by Daniel Pipes 15 years ago this month, January 1994. Our mission is to define and promote American interests in the Middle East and thereby help the United States defend herself against radical Islam. Our objectives are to encourage moderate Islam, to work toward Arab acceptance of Israel, and to prevent a nuclear-armed radical Iranian regime. Our projects include the Middle East Quarterly, a leading scholarly journal, Campus Watch, which exposes problems in the field of Middle East studies, Islamist Watch, which exposes nonviolent but radical Islamist activities, The Legal Project, which helps anti-Islamist researchers and activists protect their public freedoms of speech. We also have the Middle East Forum Educational Fund, which supports individuals and smaller organizations working in our field without whom our help, they may not be able to survive. Today's event is part of a lecture series which we present in 5 cities. I invite you to add your name to the email list at this event or in order to receive more of our materials. For more information on our current activities, please visit our website, www.meforum.org. I hope those of you who do not yet support the Middle East Forum financially will consider making a tax-deductible contribution. Before starting, may I ask each of you to turn off your cell phones. Please hold your questions and comments until the question and answer session, which I will moderate after Mr. Spencer's formal remarks. So about 3 years ago, my son bought me a book for a present. It was The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades, written by Robert Spencer. In reading it, I was struck by the author's direct, concise style. He had a delightful ability to convey large ideas in detail with organization and interest. Dare I call it a page-turner? What I learned from this was that my son knows what I like to read, but it also helped me connect a lot of different ideas that were floating around in my head about Islam and what was going on. I recommend it especially if this topic has not been part of your studies. As I have mentioned, our speaker, Robert Spencer, is the author of 8 books on Islamist extremism, including the bestseller, Politically Incorrect Guide, The Truth About Muhammad, and others. He writes weekly columns for Human Events and Front Page magazines, and since October 2003 has served as director of Jihad Watch, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, which gets 900,000 hits, roughly speaking, per month. In his new book, Stealth Jihad, How Radical Islam is Subverting America Without Guns or Bombs, which he will present to us today, he exposes the nonviolent methods that Islamists use to undermine American society. Noting the success of radical Islam strategy in Western Europe, Spencer offers alternatives in order that America may avoid being subverted from within. Steve Emerson of the investigative project called Stealth Jihad, the definitive book on radical jihadists, and our own Daniel Pipes declared it a pioneering survey of a phenomenon whose ambition and subtlety threaten the continuity of Western civilization. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome me in joining Robert, welcoming Robert Bush.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for the kind and generous introduction. I noticed that in the introduction, Mr. Levy noted the taunts of a hijabbed Muslim woman in Fort Lauderdale at a demonstration when she called out to the pro-Israeli counter-protesters, you need a big oven, get back into the ovens, and so on. I expect that you've all seen that or heard about it. I wonder if you've also heard that in Los Angeles, Muslim demonstrators shouted, "Long live Hitler, Hitler rest in peace," and again, Jews into the ovens. This was also repeated at various demonstrations in Europe and elsewhere in the United States. It's really a stunning phenomenon that is unprecedented in the history of American protests, however ugly they may have been. If you think back into the 60s and some of the violent demonstrations that were so famous at that time, never before in American history have we seen people openly on American soil and in full light of video cameras saying that they want to see a renewal of a genocidal ambition and they want to see a whole people exterminated. Never before have we seen that. And you know where we did not see it? For the most part, this week, when it's been happening, the last 2 weeks, and since the beginning of the Israeli action in Gaza, where have we not seen it? I would expect that most of you in this room are not aware of the extent of how often this is happening and where this has happened. And that's because it has not been reported. It's not been on the major mainstream media. It's not been on the television networks. Only with the notable exception of the Fort Lauderdale video, it hasn't even been covered by Fox. And these things are not getting out except in the new samizdat media of the internet, and where on websites like Jihad Watch, and I see that Pamela Geller of Atlas Shrugs is here, and she's been doing immense work on this in documenting these things, and I recommend that you all go visit that site, atlasshrugs.com. It is really remarkable that this is not capturing the attention of the American public. This ought to be the largest story of the last 20 years, or more than that, since World War II. Now, why isn't it? Why isn't it comes directly to the problem. The stealth jihad of the book's title refers to a comprehensive initiative that is designed to achieve exactly the same goal that Islamic Jihad terrorists are trying to achieve, but by means other than terrorism. Osama bin Laden has been very clear. If you have read his communiques to the American public, if you haven't, I highly recommend his letter to the American people of October 6, 2002, in which he says, the first thing we are asking of you. Do you know what Osama bin Laden is asking of us? Do you know what he wants from us? Why is he doing this? He wants us to convert to Islam. He said it very clearly. The first thing we are calling you to is Islam. What Osama bin Laden envisions, however, is not primarily the conversion, forced or willing or under the attractiveness of material advantage, not envisioning the mass conversion of Americans and Europeans. What he envisions is the implementation of Islamic law, of Sharia, over the West. And that's what he's calling us to. Islamic law is a comprehensive, in its traditional formulation, is a comprehensive program that is political as well as religious, that encompasses every aspect of human life and human behavior, and that Muslims believe, or at least traditionally as taught by all the schools of Islamic jurisprudence and the orthodox sects of Islam, it is a divine responsibility for them to work to impose this law over non-Muslim polities. And that would change fundamentally the political and social structure of those polities in ways that would be, particularly with reference to the United States, at complete variance, at 180 degree variance, with our notions of the freedom of speech, the freedom of conscience, the equality of rights of women, the equality of rights of all people before the law. All these things are denied in various ways, or denigrated, or restricted in various ways by Islamic law, by the Islamic law that the terrorists are trying to impose. Now, there are groups in the United States operating right now that have exactly the same goal. They want to impose Islamic law in the West. Now, we have already entered into a realm that may appear to you to be fanciful when I speak this way, because can we envision the United States becoming an Islamic state? I am not suggesting that. I don't think that that will ever happen. I do think, however, that we need to take note of the fact that there are groups in the United States that are working to that end, and that as they work to that end in various ways, they are already eroding the freedoms that we enjoy here. And that one notable fruit of their efforts we can see in the media over the last 2 weeks, in their utter failure to cover these genocidal rallies, and in their general abject failure to expose to Americans the full nature and magnitude of the threat from the Islamic jihadists in all its forms. Omar Ahmed is the co-founder and the former board chairman of the Council on American Islamic Relations, which is, of course, the very influential Islamic civil rights organization, so it styles itself, and which is the most influential Islamic organization for both the United States government and the mainstream media. Whenever the AP or Reuters or CBS or NBC or ABC or any of them need a spokesman to give a comment on a story about Islam, they will invariably go to CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations. The government, the United States government, has consulted with them. They have had access at high levels. They were given one of the most egregious examples was that CARE officials were given an operational tour of airport security procedures at O'Hare Airport in Chicago a few years back. The Council on American Islamic Relations, co-founder and former board chairman Omar Ahmed, said to a Muslim audience in 1998, "Islam is not in America to coexist with other religions. Islam is in America to become dominant, and the Quran the only law of the land." Now that statement, that's a seditious statement. Our elected officials, Barack Obama next week is going to take an oath of office. "I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and to the best of my ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States." The Constitution of the United States does not establish a religion. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. Islam is not in the United States to coexist with other religions, but to become dominant and the Quran the only law of the land. It's one or the other. You can't have both. And so the fact that the Council on American Islamic Relations not only is not being called to account for this is, in the first place, an abject failure of our law enforcement and government authorities. But also, it is a manifestation of just how successful they have been and how successful the Stealth Jihad Initiative has been. The Stealth Jihad Initiative involves many things. It involves insinuating elements of Islamic law into government, into media, into education, into American businesses, all these areas and more are subject to efforts that all have the effect, they are all very small efforts, taken individually, every one of them, if I had time, and I'll be able to have time probably more in the question period, to tell you, to give you more specific examples of how this is being pursued, and you'll say, well, what's the big deal? You know, people want prayer breaks, special prayer breaks at workplaces, and they want a time for prayer in public schools, and they want changes in scheduling. What's the big deal? Give it to them. We're a pluralistic society. We're one multiculturalist paradise all together. Why? Who could object? Well, we all should object, and we all should object because we need to understand that this is a comprehensive, coordinated initiative. It is not a comprehensive coordinated initiative by my word. Yesterday I was on a show on Fox and I was speaking about this, and the host was getting emails as the show progressed. And he said, give this guy a tinfoil hat, somebody wrote. It's a crazy conspiracy theory. Well, there's a difference between a conspiracy theory and a conspiracy fact. And that is whether it's really happening or not. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, that was a conspiracy theory. That was a deadly one. That was responsible for the deaths of ultimately millions of people. But the fact is, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is supposed to be the minutes of a meeting that never happened. It did not take place. There is a fundamental difference between that and the Muslim Brotherhood Memorandum that was revealed by law enforcement last year, that says that the Brotherhood, in its internal strategy, its goals for the United States, explains in its own words, the Brotherhood must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in illuminating and destroying the Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands and the hands of the believers so that it is eliminated and Allah's religion is made victorious over all other religions. I didn't write that. Daniel Pipes didn't write that. The Muslim Brotherhood wrote that. And they're pursuing it. The Muslim Brotherhood is an international organization. It is the largest Islamic organization in the world. It is noteworthy that Hamas styles itself in its charter as the Muslim Brotherhood for Palestine. In other words, we're facing exactly the same threat they are, and they're facing the same threat that we are. And it's manifesting itself in different ways in both places. But the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States is not lobbing rockets yet, not pursuing this kind of active violent engagement, because they cannot, because they know strategically it would be stupid for them to do so. 9/11 brought down the attention of law enforcement upon Islamic extremist groups in the United States to an unprecedented degree, such that Hezbollah, in another internal document uncovered recently, actually explained, we're not pursuing terrorist attacks in the United States right now, we're working through other means. They are working, the Muslim Brotherhood, through various organizations in the United States that are avowed Brotherhood-linked organizations according to, again, Brotherhood documents. The Brotherhood itself explains in the same strategic goal document for the United States that they're operating in the United States under the names of the Muslim American Society, the Muslim Students Association, the International Institute of Islamic Thought, the Islamic Society of North America, many, many others, including the Islamic Association for Palestine, which is now defunct, but which gave rise to the Council on American Islamic Relations. All those are Brotherhood organizations that are, according to Brotherhood spokesmen, working toward this goal of sabotaging Western civilization from within. Now, one of the chief aspects of that is that they are working to intimidate the mainstream media into being afraid to discuss these issues. And they have succeeded. There's never been an anti-terror measure that CARE or MPAC or ISNA or any of these other Islamic groups has liked. They're all hateful, discriminatory, and bigoted and redolent of profiling and have to be discarded. Every last one of them. There has never been an anti-terror spokesman, be it Daniel Pipes or Stephen Emerson or Spencer or Raymond Ibrahim or anybody else, who has not been a bigoted, hateful, Islamophobic, racist hate monger. Every one of them, no matter how much any one of us or anybody else who I did not mention may bend over backwards to explain, we're not saying this involves all Muslims, we're not saying that every Muslim is a terrorist, we're not saying this, we're not saying that, we're only just describing the manifest fact that there are Islamic groups in the United States that are pursuing this agenda. This has been an extraordinary victory because, of course, bigotry and racism are the national traumas. They are the great sins of American history. And so the worst thing you can be in America is a bigot and a racist. And so they have been extraordinarily skillful in portraying any honest discussion of these issues as bigotry and racism, and thereby have succeeded in making it such that it is absolutely impossible in the mainstream to discuss these issues without incurring such charges. And the result we saw this past week, in the last 2 weeks, we saw it in the failure of the mainstream media to cover these genocidal hate rallies. And what is the cumulative effect of that? Most Americans have no idea this is going on. And so they have no idea of what measures can and should be taken to counter it. And so it is able to proceed unhindered. And so with that, I will end the remarks. I understand that we're going to have a good long question period. And so I invite you to ask questions, and we will be able to get more information about this in that time. Thank you very much.
If I could just ask you to pose your questions in a brief form, and we prefer no comments, but please.
I wanted to ask if you could bring us up to date briefly, what is happening with the work that is being done in the colleges, because they are really the leaders of the future, and things are going quite badly like a year ago, and some of us are not aware of, is it still getting worse and worse, or is it...
The question is, can you update us on the situation in the colleges? And the situation in American universities is very bad. This is one of the chief arenas of the stealth jihad. That in the first place, there is an entity that you may be aware of known as the Middle East Studies Association, or as my friend and colleague Hugh Fitzgerald at Jihad Watch calls it, Mesa Nostra. Because the Middle East Studies Association is an association of professors who are the professors of Islamic studies and related fields in American universities. And you have to be in Mesa to get a job in an American university. And to be in Mesa, you have to be holding the acceptable opinions. Why is Daniel Pipes not a professor at a major American university? Because he does not hold to the party line about Islam as a religion of peace that has been hijacked by a tiny minority of extremists, that really the problem is all the United States and Israel, and if the United States were to abandon Israel and Israel were not to exist, then a new era of peace would dawn in the world. If you don't believe that, you can't get a job. And so what happens? These people are being taught this in universities all over the country. They're being taught these things as a matter of course. And then they hear one of us speak. You know, both Daniel Pipes and I have been touring colleges extensively all around the country and meeting with extraordinarily hostile crowds of these propagandized, ignorant students who are being manipulated by these professors. And, you know, the idea that any speaker on an American college campus in 2009 would have to go with bodyguards, or that the students would have to be reminded not to throw things or to charge the stage, this is a scandal, really. This is something, you know, people are complacent about it and are ignorant about it. But it's a manifestation of how the same initiative is being pursued on college campuses and is bearing bitter fruit there also.
What's the genesis of the Muslim Brotherhood?
The Muslim Brotherhood, I'm sorry.
And why, if their own Muslim majority countries are so problematic politically, economically, why they turn into the West?
It's a contradiction. I'll take the second part first. Said Qutb, who is the chief theorist of the Muslim Brotherhood, and whose writings are very, very influential to this day, you could walk into any Islamic bookstore, which you may not be well advised to do, but if you happen to have one around nearby, walk in and ask if they have the writings of Said Qutb, Qutb. I guarantee you they will. You go to IslamicBookstore.com or Islamicity.com online, you find his books readily, and he's calling for jihad against the West. He's calling for the destruction of Western civilization. He's calling for the imposition of Islamic law quite openly. His book Milestones, as a matter of fact, is a very brief and powerful summation of the Islamic jihad agenda, which I recommend, actually, just for your information, if you really want to know how they think and what they're about. Milestones by Said Qutb. But in any case, he, because it's consistent with his worldview, he promises that if you obey a law and if you implement his law in society, then prosperity will ensue. Well, obviously, that is not the case. Obviously, when Islamic law is implemented in societies, they don't prosper. And so there's a cognitive dissonance that is created. And how does somebody like Sayyid Qutb explain that? By demonizing the enemies of Islam. And then the Quran in chapter 5, verse 82 says, the worst enemies you will encounter as believers will be the Jews. And so it must be the Jews' fault if we are not prospering, because we're doing everything that we're supposed to do. And we, in this line of thinking we see played out in the headlines every day. The Muslim Brotherhood in general was founded in 1928 in Egypt by Hassan al-Banna, who taught very, very strongly that the Islamic world had lost its way by abandoning the principles of political Islam, and that particularly with the abolition of the caliphate, which was the center of political Islam, the symbol of Muslim unity, and it was abolished by the secular Turkish government in 1924, which is a huge event, tantamount to a Muslim army going into Rome and abolishing the papacy. And immediately there was a reaction, and the most powerful reaction to the abolition of the caliphate was the establishment of the Brotherhood in Egypt. Started out as a small society and grew very quickly, such that it is now of international extent. It is dedicated. You know, what's really scandalous about the Brotherhood, among many things, is that there's so many voices in the State Department and influential in Washington who are advocating that the U.S. government play ball with them. Robert Lichen wrote an article about this of the Nixon Center, saying the Muslim Brotherhood is moderate, and so we should play ball with the Muslim Brotherhood. What makes the Muslim Brotherhood moderate? Well, they're not blowing things up. But of course, that assumption that anybody who's not blowing something up must be a moderate rests on a complete ignorance of the fact of the stealth jihad and of the fact that the same agenda of implementing Islamic law, imposing Islamic law, bit by bit and piece by piece over the West is being pursued in other ways that have nothing to do with violence. But the goal remains the same, and the Brotherhood has been completely consistent about the goal while pursuing it with different tactics in different areas of the world.
Young lady.
Robert, could you please explain, or anybody in this room who knows, what did happen, what has happened to the laws of sedition, or the laws of inciting to violence? I always was raised to believe that we had laws that if you went out the streets and you extolled violence toward anyone or any group or anything, and particularly toward the government, this was an arrestable offense. If you're arrested, you would be in prison. And somehow people seem to be able to do this all over, everywhere, and nothing happens to them.
Mallory, you're quite right. You're quite right, and I stole your book. I'll give it right back. But it's a failure. There are existing laws that ought to be enforced to deal with this problem. And if they were enforced, then we would go a long way toward rolling back these initiatives. The section 2385 of the Federal Criminal Code says this: whoever knowingly or willfully advocates, abets, advises, or teaches the duty, necessity, desirability, or propriety of overthrowing or destroying the government of the United States, or the government of any state, territory, district, or possession thereof, or the government of any political subdivision therein, by force or violence, or by the assassination of any officer of any such government, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both, etc., etc. There are Muslim speakers who are doing exactly that, sponsored by Muslim students' associations, going to American college campuses right now and teaching this kind of thing. There are Muslim spokesmen in the United States who have been teaching this kind of thing. And they're not prosecuted under these laws because of multiculturalism and fear, and because the enforcers have become sclerotic. And so, we could go a long way toward rectifying this problem simply by recovering a sense of who we are and enforcing existing laws.
So just before I ask that question, why are the Jewish organizations not following up and suing?
The question is, why are the Jewish organizations not suing on this basis. I wish I knew. I mean, this. I think that part of it, a key element of that, is the ignorance in general about this issue. So people don't realize what's at stake. They don't realize what's threatened right now.
In a similar vein, you mentioned the oil the president takes, and millions of people have to take. In theory, isn't an open proponent of the imposition of Sharia in the United States precluded from taking such an oath of office?
Of course. Well, see, this is the difficulty is that obviously, yes, an open proponent of Sharia cannot or should not swear to uphold and defend the U.S. Constitution because Sharia would dictate that he wants to destroy that Constitution. On the other hand, Sharia also allows for dissimulation when under pressure and lying to unbelievers. And so a proponent of Sharia would have no trouble taking the oath. But the defenders of the Constitution ought to be aware that a proponent of Sharia should not be eligible. Now, when it comes to that, I think that we have a case. We have a case before us already in Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota, who received funding from the Council on American Islamic Relations, has been, as a matter of fact, his Hajj, his pilgrimage to Mecca, was funded by the Muslim American Society, which is the chief Muslim Brotherhood organization in the United States. Now, let me ask you this. I read to you before that the Brotherhood is engaged in a kind of grand jihad, in its own words, right, aimed at eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within. Now, imagine if someone were a Christian fundamentalist congressman, and Christian fundamentalist congressman was paid by a Christian fundamentalist group to take a trip to Jerusalem to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And the Christian fundamentalist group that paid him said, we really want to institute biblical law in the United States and replace the U.S. Constitution with the laws of Jesus Christ. Do you think that that might attract some notice in the media? I expect that we would hear about nothing else for weeks from the New York Times and from CNN and MSNBC. And yet nobody has noticed that the Muslim American Society sent Ellison to Mecca. And, you know, questions ought to be asked. I'm not saying he's necessarily taken the oath in bad faith, but why can't we even ask the question? Because it's racist.
Young lady in the back first, then you, sir, next.
I also think that part of the problem is you can't use the law if you're not even close to it because we're not calling it Islamic terrorism. Communism and all the laws that actually were utilized too much bigger. And back then, we had a leader. Today we're not labeling an enemy, so therefore when you try to take series of activities and connect it to the word tradition, there's a huge information gap that prevents people from realizing the probably cause or
motivation. Yes, and that's one of the chief achievements of the stealth jihadist initiatives in the United States has been to muddy the waters and confuse people about the nature of what we're facing. And one of their main efforts has been to make it unacceptable for people to speak about Islam in connection with terrorism. The State Department and the Department of Homeland Security actually adopted guidelines that forbid them, voluntarily forbidding themselves, from speaking about Islam or jihad in connection with terrorism. Now, that's palpably ridiculous, because whether you believe that Islam is a religion of peace that's been hijacked or whatever or not, the reality is that the Islamic jihadists explain what they're doing in terms of the Quran, in terms of Muhammad's example, in terms of the teachings of Islamic law. So if you're going to know your enemy, as Sun Tzu advised, if you're going to understand what your enemy is up to so as to devise the best strategy to defeat him, you have to investigate the Islamic jihad doctrine as it is taught in the Quran and in all the schools of Islamic jurisprudence. And so the real kicker about this is that the State Department and DHS adopted these guidelines on the advice of Muslim advisors, all of whom had links to the Brotherhood organizations. And so, yes, in the first place, we can't deal with this because we cannot speak accurately about the nature of the enemy or about the fact that Islamic jihad, the doctrines of warfare against unbelievers and their subjugation, those things are embedded. Those things are in the Quran. Those things are taught by all the schools of Islamic law. It's not a twisting or hijacking of Islam. I'm sorry, it's just not the way it is. Now, even worse, there's something else. That is that people are afraid to discuss this because it is a religious thing. Do you remember when Russia invaded Georgia last year? I watched some of the coverage of that, and you know what struck me over and over again? How relieved all the commentators were. They were. You can see it on their faces. Finally, they could speak about an enemy openly. Finally, they could discuss clearly. And they said, you know, Russia has always been imperialistic. And Russia has always had designs on its neighbors. And here goes the Russian bear gobbling up one of its neighbors yet again. And these guys, they loved this. Because, I mean, it's a true statement. It's just the way it is. But nobody was going to call them Russophobic. Nobody was going to call them bigoted. And yet, if you had said after 9/11, well, this is Islam. This is the way Islam is. Islam has always been imperialistic, supremacist, and totalitarian. It's always had designs on non-Muslim polities. You would have been run out of town on a rail. And so the commentators were relieved because finally they were free of all these politically correct restrictions that they've been laboring under for so many years to avoid offending Islam. When, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, it has gotten me the same kind of charges, of course, and the same kind of marginalization, but I don't think there's anything gained by not telling the truth about this. And ultimately, the truth will out one way or the other anyway. I'm sorry, you're doing that. I'm sorry.
Right. I just wanted to solidify and add some color to something that you said at the beginning. This past Sunday, my wife and I were at the Time Warner Center, and as we were going out of the building, we saw about 10, 20 police cars, and the loudspeakers chanting the name of the God of Islam, shrieking. And we noticed there were hundreds and literally hundreds of people who were demonstrating against the war in front of the CNN building. But what I found so striking and so frightening was that they brought in a muezzin, an Islamic speaker, to chant the name of their God repeatedly to incite the crowd. And it was the most violent, hate-filled demonstration I've ever witnessed. It actually scared me to the bone to experience this. Firsthand.
Well, you know, incidentally, when you say scared to the bone, you remind me of something Muhammad Atta once said. You remember Muhammad Atta? He left some writings behind, some letters, and in one of them, he was writing to some of his fellow warriors, and he said, "Be sure when you begin your operation," and he was talking about hijacking an airplane, "when you stand up on the airplane, shout Allahu Akbar, because that strikes terror into the hearts of the unbelievers." And we see this Allahu Akbar in all over the place in these genocidal rallies over the last few weeks in New York and elsewhere.
And that's what they like to do before they cut off heads or murder. Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the chapter 8, verse 60 of the Quran says that it is the responsibility of believers to strike terror into the hearts of the enemies of Allah. And you strike terror into the hearts of the enemies of Allah, you shout this Allahu Akbar, which is God is greatest, not just God is great, but God is greater, my God's greater than your God. And then do these acts of violence. And it's definitely meant to intimidate, yes.
Can you just say something about Saudi funding of Muslim Brotherhood organizations in the United States?
Sure. Saudis are the chief culprits here, really. They're the chief bankrollers. And it's been documented again and again. Sheikh Mohammed Hisham Kabbani, well over 10 years ago, is it that long now? Oh, just about 10 years ago. Spoke at a State Department open forum, and he said, after he had made an extensive investigation, including personal visits, to over 100 American mosques, he said to the State Department that 80% were controlled by extremists. And it just happens that 80% of American mosques are bankrolled by Saudis. What a coincidence. And of course, the Saudis also supply, when they give you money, they supply textbooks, they supply other information and materials for the mosques and the Islamic schools. And then the Center for Religious Freedom in 2005 made a survey, which is readily available online, Center for Religious Freedom, 2005 survey on what is taught in American mosques, and they found, well, about 80% teach hatred of Jews and Christians and the necessity ultimately to overthrow the U.S. Constitution and replace it with Islamic law. This is no accident. This is what the Saudis are actively pursuing. Did you know that over 2 years after 9/11, up until November 2003, when the superb Middle East Media Institute, Middle East Media Research Institute memory, when they called attention to it in November 2003, only then did the Saudis take it down. But up until then, for 2 years after 9/11, the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. had a section about Islam on its website, readily available in English, explaining that it was the responsibility of Muslims to wage war against and subjugate Jews and Christians, to impose Islamic law, and that Muslims in America must ultimately do this also. Now, why is it that memory had to uncover that? Why is it nobody in the State Department noticed that when they were dealing with our friend and ally in Riyadh?
I have to disagree with some of the things you've said. I believe there are established organizations, made up of Muslims, living in the United States, and willing and openly will speak against what the Muslim religion is doing now, what the Muslim people are doing now. I personally brought one young lady who now lives in Canada. She was born in Uganda. She is...
Irshad Manji?
Yes.
Yeah.
Why don't you bring her to New York?
Well, I don't bring people in anywhere. I'm not sponsor speakers. I'm a speaker myself. But actually, the reality of the situation is, I mean, I guess I have to say it here again, okay? I didn't say all Muslims are doing this. I didn't say all Muslim organizations are doing this. The American Islamic Forum for Democracy out of Arizona is doing good work. I met, I can't remember now, there's another organization in Washington. I'm sorry, I don't know the name of it offhand. American Islamic Congress, thank you. That is the one, yes. And they are working to do this, but we shouldn't have any illusions about the relative size and strength in terms of numbers and in terms of influence of both of the various groups. And so certainly there are courageous people who exist who are working against this. But let me give you an example. Jamal Miftah is in the news today. Do you know Jamal Miftah? Jamal Miftah dropped his lawsuit just today. I'm sorry that he did that, and I don't know the circumstances. But he was suing his mosque in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Jamal Miftah is a Muslim who wrote an op-ed against Osama bin Laden and terrorism in the Tulsa paper a few years back, whereupon he was summarily expelled from his mosque by the Saudi-funded leadership. And there is another American Muslim, a very high-profile, moderate American Muslim, who is regularly featured on CNN and Fox, and who has also recently been expelled from his mosque. I don't want to give you his name because I'm not sure it's public information at this point. But these people exist, yes, but they face tremendous odds, and so we shouldn't have any illusions that, I mean, I think that one of the unfortunate consequences of all the attention that these people give, and they are given an extraordinary amount of attention by the mainstream media, which is so hungry to find moderate Muslims and to show that there is another face of Islam. So people like, you know, you can turn on the TV at any given moment and find Irshad speaking. The reality of the situation is that they do not have large followings. And it misleads the American people into thinking that they do when they are so regularly featured. I'm glad of them and I support them. I just think we should do so with open eyes.
With open
eyes. With an understanding of the full reality of the situation.
I just want to mention that Irshad Manji and a number of other... Irshad Manji and a number of other moderate Muslims in North America are good friends of ours at the Middle East Forum, and we have great relations, but there's...
How many times have you had her speak a year?
Well, she hasn't been here this year, but the
Look,
point...
I'll tell you something. In all seriousness, Irshad Manji gets a whole lot more media attention than I do.
Yes. I'd like to make the point, though, that one of the problems the Muslims have is being associated... It undermines what they're doing in their communities to be associated with us or other Jewish organizations and so on. So they often just like keep it quiet.
She doesn't want to keep it quiet. I can tell you that. She told me this within the last month.
Mm-hmm. Want to get another question?
Yes.
Or is this all going to be about her show?
Thank you. Okay. Anyway, sir, and then the two ladies right there.
Dentist last night in Toronto, who had hired a young Muslim dental assistant, 3 months and one day after she was an employee, she suddenly got religion and announced to him that she was going to come to work in a full garb, you know, to cover, you know. Apparently there's a law up there that after 3 months you can't dismiss someone or they...
Is that right? And 3 months in one day? Well, obviously it was planned then, from the beginning.
Yeah, and she, he suffered from that, and she comes every day, pulling me down.
I don't think that's...
Don't think it's pertinent?
Anyway. Ladies.
Well, actually, I think it is.
Did you have a question?
I'll tell you. Because, yeah, just a second. Because the visible presence, you know, people are free to wear hijab or not wear hijab as they choose. And I expect that that's your point. But there is definitely an assertiveness that is part of the attempt to make this a more visible presence in the United States. This is something that, here again, you know, you can don't have to believe me. You can go to the websites of Islamic organizations and see them exhorting women to wear hijab and to do so to show the unbelievers that Islam is on the rise and on the march. And so the idea that she would do this 3 months in one day after being hired does have a certain, it lends an aura of calculation to the whole thing that I think we would be excused for noticing.
Can employers, at least the United States, dictate how an employee has to dress for the job?
Well, see, this is a problematic area. Can employers dictate how employees have to dress? The Somali workers in the Phoenix airport, they were janitorial workers, and the janitorial company that they worked for recently mandated that they all wear slacks. And the Muslim women, female Muslim employees said they would not, and they went to court, and they won. And so here, you know, this is a minor thing, and people will think, well, it's a reasonable accommodation. It's just like saying that a Jewish worker in some place can wear kippah and so on. It's a little bit more than that, and it's more than that because, in the first place, the Brotherhood, once again, is always involved. There's always a Muslim Brotherhood organization. You know, Daniel Pipes, as I'm sure you're aware, did some great work in detailing the alcohol cab controversy in Minneapolis, where the cabbies were refusing to carry alcohol, carry passengers who had alcohol. The one notable aspect of that is that they only did that after a fatwa from the Muslim American Society, which is the foremost Brotherhood organization in the United States. After the fatwa came out, it said, you can't do this. You know, Muhammad said, you can't drink alcohol, but not only can you not drink it, you can't transport it, you can't carry it, you can't sell it, you can't have anything to do with it. Now, never before, I mean, I myself, I can testify, I have bought alcohol from Muslim shop owners many times, and they had no problem selling it to me. But at the same time, I mean, and that was under the auspices, not that they were all bad Muslims, but that this was a law that was never considered to be something that had to be pressed. And then they began to press it, and they began to press it under Brotherhood influence. Now, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, has mandated that there ought to be reasonable accommodation of religious practices in the workplace. And so an employer can dictate what an employee can wear, but then if an employee wants to opt out of that for religious reasons, the EEOC will likely side with him, and the courts will also. And so there is an extent to which that's benign, but when it comes to being pushed forward by the people who are pushing this agenda, it becomes something else again. I mean, an example, this is not a dress code example, but it's an example, I think, in which the analogy holds in any case. The problem is the erosion of the idea of equality of treatment and equality of access and equality of rights before the law. And that is directly what's trying to be eroded by the Muslim Brotherhood, by their own words. They want to make Allah's religion victorious over other religions, which is not a mandate for equality. In the Swift meatpacking plants in Nebraska and Colorado, the Muslim workers last summer asked for permission to get a special break time on second shift so they could celebrate break the Ramadan fast at the proper time. And the companies, mindful of EEOC regulations, readily agreed. Then something happened that nobody at all expected, and that was that the non-Muslim workers protested. And this was not a racial issue. These were Hispanic workers, black workers, and so on. And they said, you're discriminating against us now. We have to work longer hours to make up for the break time these people have. And see, this is the difficulty. If you treat everyone equally and you say everybody's going to take a break at this time, if you want to have this job, these are the parameters of the job, and you can either have the job or not have the job, that's fine. But when you begin to say, we're going to have one set of rules for the Muslim employees and another set of rules for the non-Muslim employees, you are eroding one of the most hard-won victories of the civil rights movement, which was equality of treatment before the law. And you know, you can shake your head and poo-poo that, but the implications of it are very large, especially when you see once again that there's brotherhood involvement in this initiative.
Do you still have your question? Yes.
Okay. I come from a background which is multicultural. We have all the religions you can possibly think of. I was born in India, and I think, I haven't read your book, but I want to ask you, we ought to look at the history of the Muslims and how they converted people. I think the fundamental basic problem in this world about religion is the practice of trying to convert everybody. The Christians did it for a long time, and they are at peace now. We don't do that. The Muslims still continue to do it. And if you look at the history in India, how we converted everybody to Islam in the other population. And you were talking about the constitution and law. In India, when they went to independence and they parted the country in two, they parted it because of religion.
Of course.
And in India, the Muslims are allowed to practice their religious law over and above what the constitution dictates. So they are given exception to all these rules.
Yes.
We also ought to study the history of how they spread their religions all over the world.
These things are very important areas of study, and I do actually touch upon them, not so much in this book, but in some other books. But in any case, about conversion, proselytizing is something that a lot of religious groups do, and people may approve or disapprove of proselytizing. But I tell you, you know, sometimes I'm at home, and I must be on the Mormon circuit. I get the Mormons like every few weeks, and I say, you guys just came here. You know, what is it? And I don't know, they have me especially on their list. But you know something? I don't convert, I don't become a Mormon, and they go away. Now, in contrast, Muhammad said, first invite the unbelievers to accept Islam. If they accept it, then don't fight them. But if they do not accept it, then invite them to enter the Islamic social order by paying the special poll tax that's mandated in the Quran and accepting, in other words, subservient status, subjugated status under the rule of Islamic law. This is Muhammad. It's in the Hadith, Sahih Muslim 4294. And if they refuse both, if they refuse to convert and they refuse to submit, then go to war with them. Conversion, subjugation, or war delineated by Muhammad and by Islamic law. You can check this out. These are verifiable facts. And they are delineated by Muhammad and Islamic law as being the choices for unbelievers. And so that's different. You know, if the Mormons come and knock on my door and I say no, they go away, at least for a couple weeks. But when the Muslims invite us to accept Islam, under the traditional canons of Islamic law, what follows then, if we refuse, is warfare. And that makes the proselytizing, it puts them in a very different light.
Go ahead, and one more question. I think you've been waiting for a while.
Isn't our major problem, as Daniel Pipe said, the mislabeling of the enemy here in the United States, relating it to terrorism as opposed to the extreme jihad?
Oh, yeah.
I asked Mort Zuckerman, who's a media guy,
yeah,
why we have this problem. He stated there's no central figure that advocates this position.
Which position exactly?
The position of the fact that we've mislabeled it as terrorism.
Yeah.
As opposed to the extreme jihad.
Oh, sure. Nobody's talking about that at all.
And,
I mean,
you know, we have a Jimmy Carter on the other side. But we don't have a non-Jewish person.
We don't have an anti-Jimmy Carter. Yeah.
Right. Who was central, who was credible.
Yes, who was president. I mean,
well,
you know,
right,
we could use an ex-president.
Or the media that was so dissipated.
On the payroll of the Saudis.
Yeah, sure they are. Sure they are. You saw how Clinton is getting so many millions from these Arab entities. It's, you know, you think there's no effect to that?
Can we find a credible person that can present this correctly?
Well, I'm not sure it's a matter of credible. I mean, I don't know that the problem is credible. The problem is that the fonts of information are already under the control of people who are not hospitable to this point of view. I mean, you know, in a perfect world, then this perspective would be featured prominently. But it isn't, and it isn't because on purpose these people are either in the tank, they're either on the payroll, or they are afraid and they're intimidated by the specter of being called a bigot. And so this doesn't get out. But you're absolutely right. There's a fundamental misperception that comes from labeling the thing terrorism. I have tried to explain the many other examples I could give you that are in the book, and they explain how this agenda is being advanced through non-terrorist means. But both McCain and Obama, during the presidential election, when they spoke about this at all, which was very seldom, they only spoke about it in terms of terrorism and forestalling the next terror attack. That has to be done, obviously. But there's a whole lot more. There's many other dimensions to this threat that are simply not being addressed anywhere.
Last question.
You spoke of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's the Sunni organization. How about Iran? How do they fit in with this whole caliphate theory?
Yeah.
The Sun went out of business, obviously, so is there an outlet where you can send in stories on the caliphate and such?
Only online, as far as I know.
Before you answer, I just want to invite everyone to buy Mr. Spencer's book at the bookseller in the back of the room after we're finished here today. Read it and pass it on to a friend. Anyway, thank you for coming. This is the last.
Very briefly, the Sunnis and the Shiites do not disagree in the traditional formulations of their authoritative schools of jurisprudence about the necessity to wage jihad against unbelievers and subjugate them. The caliphate, however, is a Sunni institution. The Shiites have a completely different understanding of the nature of authority in Islam. But both of them share the idea that it is the responsibility of believers to wage war against unbelievers, war by various means, not necessarily always a hot war, and to subjugate them. And so you see, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, he does not want to establish the caliphate. He would probably regard a restored caliphate as his enemy. But he nonetheless is making common cause with Sunni groups like Hamas and funding Hamas, because they both have a common interest in subjugating the infidel. And so even though what they would do next differs markedly, they don't have any problem cooperating toward that end. Thank you very much.